Hi, my name is Rosie Frasso, and I'm from the University of Pennsylvania. This is a piece of a project I worked on with several colleagues, and I'll tell you about them as we go along. We worked collaboratively with the Health Department of the City of Philadelphia, some undergraduate students, some MPH students, and folks who work in the Health Department on a study to inform Philadelphia's Get Healthy Philly program. I do need to disclose that funding for this project was made possible in part by a cooperative agreement with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the Department of Health and Human Services, and Get Healthy Philly, an initiative in the Philadelphia Health Department. Anything we say or do today talking about food or products does not reflect opinions of the government. You got that? Okay. So I'll quickly go over the background of this project, the methods we employed, which I think are novel and exciting, and I'm hoping that folks will find them so, some results in our next steps. So again, the purpose of this study was to provide the Philadelphia Health Department with consumer perspectives about their experiences shopping for healthy food in Philadelphia. They're collaborating with supermarkets, and they wanted to bring the voice of the consumer to the table to help supermarkets engage and be invested in change that would promote healthy eating. So they enlisted folks at the University of Pennsylvania to help design a study that would do that. So we employed walking interviews as a form of triangulation with data we obtained in a larger focus group study, and we're going to focus on the walking interviews today. So the protocol was adapted from ACORN, which is a project that was done in Little Rock, Arkansas by Dr. Shariki Kumanika, the next president of APHA, and with input from the Philadelphia Health Department, Penn Center for Public Health Initiatives, and our own mixed methods research lab. We employed walking interviews. The guides are sort of the semi-structured interviews, but you have to be really, really flexible to employ this approach. And IRB approval was granted from the city and from the University of Pennsylvania. Again, we'll focus on the walking interviews, but this is part of a bigger study with 8 focus groups, 76 participants, and a larger survey. So focus groups often rely on particular reflection of an experience, and walking interviews allow the research team to really interact with participants while they're engaging with the activity that you're interested in. Participants were asked to share their thoughts while they were shopping in their local supermarket, managing the challenges that they face every day when they try to buy food. Let me tell you a little bit about the logistics of employing this approach and some of the equipment. This is one of my students who posed as a model, hoping I'd give him extra credit. So what we did is we bought equipment that we had a microphone, a digital recorder that was on a lanyard with a lapel microphone. And there are definitely some benefits to employing this approach and some challenges too. Both the interviewer and the participant are mic'd and rigged with equipment for this procedure. Just because you're doing this work in a noisy supermarket, you're traveling, you're moving, people are bumping around, and we wanted a double set of recordings so that we would get the most accurate transcript. So logistically, there are some challenges. It's noisy. You're not alone in the supermarket. It's not like sitting in a room and doing an in-depth interview. You're moving. The equipment's moving. A couple of occasions, one of the recorders was shut off. One of the microphones was shut off. Luckily, we had two. You're walking and talking, and that's not everybody's bailiwick. If that's not something you do and do well, that this may not be an approach that you want to employ. It's not an approach for the novice interviewer. I would argue that you need to be a little bit seasoned as an interviewer to try to do an interview like this. I would also say that if you're going to try this approach, you would want to really practice the interview process with a friend or a colleague and sort of go through a supermarket once or twice. You do need to worry about social desirability bias, but that's always the case in qualitative work, and I would argue that actually once you're in this natural environment and people are on a mission, that some of that may even go away, and of course, the reactivity. So some advantages is this equipment is now pretty accessible. Years ago, it would have cost a fortune to sort of rig somebody up with a lapel mic and an audio recorder, and now you can buy the equipment for under $50 and do this pretty well. The public is also very desensitized to folks walking around with stuff hanging off of them that they are talking into. We had really anticipated sticking out like a sore thumb in the supermarket, and we were kind of ready for that. Nobody cared. Nobody noticed. No one even batted an eye. And a colleague of mine is in the audience. He's doing several of these interviews, and I think you had the same experience. Yeah. No one cares because everybody's rigged up. The approach definitely eliminates recall bias, and you have this real-time data collection, which really allows for this nimble questioning, because you're in the lived experience, and you can sort of figure out what it is you need to know from the folks that have given you their time in the supermarket. Recruitment for the walking interviews, our study team kind of hung out in front of a grocery store. They identified participants in this on-site way in supermarkets in Philadelphia, in West Philadelphia and North Philadelphia, pretty poor neighborhoods in our city. So data collection, again, everything was recorded, transcribed verbatim, not easy because you had these two recordings, lots of noise, lots of background noise. The data was entered into an in vivo database, and we developed a code book with input from folks that do this work in food and nutrition. I'm a methodologist by training. I kind of lay qualitative methods on all kinds of issues and projects, so I don't have the content area and food environment stuff, but it was the method that I brought to the table. So we needed input from collaborators that knew this environment as we developed our code book. We conducted a systematic analysis, and while it says only four were double-coded, all transcripts were double-coded. That's an error. So we had eight focus groups with 76 participants, and we had this set of 16 walking interviews that helped us shed light on this issue in the city of Philadelphia. We had a diverse population, for sure, in terms of age, but ethnically, most of our participants are African American. So what did we learn in the focus groups? We learned that making food choices was an important issue for families struggling with food access in Philadelphia. Price and merchant allegiance was also very important to folks. The supermarket setting itself was important. And they wanted to talk about where they learned or knew how to eat and what they knew about healthy eating. They talked a lot about family and cultural influences, opportunities and challenges to improve the way they feed their families. They gave us very specific suggestions to share with supermarket owners. People were very empowered by this opportunity to know that we were going to deliver their message back to the people that owned and operated the stores in their neighborhoods. And they defined healthy food for us. So that was the focus group side, and we wanted to use the walking interviews to sort of confirm what we learned in the focus groups. And things came up that were similar, but not completely. So the folks doing the walking interviews talked a lot about how they prepared to shop and what went into that and how they went about shopping, what was their routine in the supermarket. They talked a lot about shopping for their children that weren't with them and a lot about what it's like to shop with children. And if you've ever done it, it's not the easiest thing. They talked about the supermarket materials, what's available to them as a resource in this setting. They talked about how they assessed food on the fly, and we were able to talk to them and walk them. They walked us through what they do when they make choices to put things in their food cart. And they also talked about smoking. This did not come up in the focus groups, but when we were in the supermarkets with consumers, we encountered tobacco products, so that came to the table and we discussed that. So again, they talked about preparing to shop. Folks made lists, they cut out coupons, they used the flyers that were available to them. Some of this was done in advance, some of it was done in the supermarket. They talked about the timing and how often they shopped. It varied. People shopped daily. Some people shopped monthly. A lot of it was based on budget. Some participants came to the store with a spending limit. Others kept a tally as they go. There was definitely issues of limited cash and limited food stamps. You know, many shoppers stick to their list, you know, very, very clearly, and others really were responsive to sales and cravings and most responsive to children's demands in aisle four. When you're trying to get through your shopping tour. So one quote someone shared with us is, sometimes when you come in, they might have sales in the paper, but sometimes they might have a sale of the week and something like that, and it might be like the manager's special or something. So I'd be like, oh, that's not bad, because normally that costs this X, Y, and Z, and it's a little cheaper, so let me grab it while I'm here. So they're quite influenced by what's happening in the setting, and we had very rich conversations about that, and they had great suggestions about what that should look like going forward. Shopping with children, I don't think this will be a surprise to anybody. They prioritize their children's food preferences. They talked a lot about wanting to buy food that children would eat so that it wouldn't be wasted because their budgets were quite limited. So even though they knew there were healthier choices to be made, and even if they could afford those healthier choices in that moment, they were worried about wasting food. So they didn't experiment. They didn't try new things. They weren't willing to put the money down on the table, not knowing whether the child would eat it or not. They found shopping with children challenging and distracting. But many reported that it's a good opportunity to teach children about food and what can be healthy and what food labels are about. For the four-year-old, he's going to have a fit if I don't get it. The one-year-old, not so much. The seven-year-old, I can talk her down. The four-year-old, it's just not happening. It's hopeless. And that's something that people really, you know, talk to us a lot about. And really, they had very creative ideas about how the supermarket could help them manage those encounters with their children in the site. Supermarket materials, people talked about the circulars and that they needed to be easier to understand than what they were. Several respondents talked about their difficulty in understanding and appreciating what is supposed to be learned from the nutrition label. Food assessment, they talked at great length about how they make decisions about what to buy. Folks talked about looking at sodium content, calorie content, the number of vitamins and minerals, and picking food that seemed rich in those things. Things with limited sugar, their allegiance to brand names for sure, and they talked about freshness a lot because this was a challenge in some of these poor neighborhoods where stuff on the counter and stuff available is not quite fresh. When tobacco products were encountered in the supermarket, the interviewers asked respondents questions about what role tobacco played in their lives. And among those who did smoke, most of them did not report exclusively buying tobacco products in the supermarket. So many respondents spoke freely about the impact of smoking on their lives. If they were not a smoker, if they had a smoker in their life, they spoke about that with us. So I wanted just to look at a little bit of the focus group data compared to the walking interview data, and you can see the major themes that came out in both of these approaches, where there was overlap, but where there was some unique opportunities. So again, when you're in the space and in the experience, people were talking more deeply about what it is that they encountered and what decisions they made. So in this study, the data derived from the walking interviews helped us understand the focus group findings, but if we were to do it again, I think doing the walking interviews first would have informed a focus group guide that would have been really rich, I think, and more productive. I also think it would have helped the focus group moderators to be engaged in the space and be able to more effectively moderate these discussions. And I think it would have led to sort of richer understanding of the experience. You know, we tried to use a pretty uniform guide with the walking interviews, but again, it really is something that you have to be prepared to do on the fly. You have to understand the bigger question that you're asking. There's definitely limitations. You know, while we attempted to engage a representative sample of consumers with some inclusion criteria that we had set aside, we wanted people that had children under the age of 18, they were shopping for them. It's unlikely that we really represent all the stakeholders in a study like this. All the walking interviews were conducted in English. You know, it's self-report data, so that's always subject to bias. And there's certainly selection bias must be considered when we choose the sites that we did to sample. We were really sort of playing with this method as an augmentation of the focus group method. And we just wanted to come talk to you today about how actually we think it's a rich approach to shedding light on this phenomena. Participants had great suggestions about improved educational programming in the store, changes in the marketing and promotion practices, and I want to be sure to share their suggestions because that's how we engaged them in the interview, that we were taking their suggestions forward. We'd bring them back to the supermarkets, we'd share them at places like this, and this is what they're telling us. They wanted a change in the organization of the store, much of the things that you all say. They encounter unhealthy food at the entrance, at the checkout. They want that to change. They want packaging of the healthier food to be appealing to children. They wanted to talk about educational opportunities in the supermarket, in-store videos, in-store cooking and shopping, in-store print materials that could help. Many of the folks on the interviews and in the focus groups talked about occasional encounters in higher-end grocery stores where education was happening in that setting, and they felt sort of deprived of that, wasn't happening in their local grocery stores. They had lots of suggestions about marketing and promotion, increasing the advertisement of fruits and vegetables, highlighting the healthier foods, putting those on the special displays to get attention, even enticing children to eat healthy by decorating bananas with funny faces and using packaging strategies that work well for unhealthy food in the healthy food setting and environment. Again, organization of the store was a priority for everyone. They wanted it set up differently. They felt that really changed their ability to shop healthy. Well, any questions about this approach or what we learned, I'm happy to answer.